This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Stock prices soared to record levels today as investors brushed off fears about Iraq and the Asia crisis. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 115 points to finish at an all-time high of 82.95. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up about 1%. The stock market has now rebounded completely from its big drop back in October. But analysts say the current mood of complacency among investors could be a mistake. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Only a few months ago, investors were convinced that the economic turmoil in Asia would hurt U.S. companies, either because Asian manufacturers would flood the U.S. with cheap exports or because the slowdown in the region would reduce demand for U.S. goods. But so far, none of that has happened. Instead, Asian governments are taking steps to solve their problems. The trade gap is stable, and corporate profits were higher than expected in the last 3 months of 1997. All that has helped calm investors considerably, according to Larry Rice, Chief Investment Officer at Joseph Thal & Company.
It's the absence of problems. It's, as somebody said over the weekend in one of the publications, a market that is priced for perfection.
Today, the surge in investor confidence helped push stock prices up to new highs, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average beating the record it set last August 6th. At one point in the day, the Dow actually rose above 8,300 for the first time. Analysts say other factors may have played a part in today's rise, including last week's decision by the Federal Reserve not to raise interest rates, and more recently, an apparent lessening of tensions with Iraq. But changing perceptions about Asia are widely seen as the chief reason for the market's turnaround. The renewed optimism about Asia perplexes some analysts. Some note that while governments of the region have begun implementing reforms, it's not at all clear how things will turn out there. Overall, says Eric Miller, Chief Investment Officer at Donaldson Lufkin Jenrette, there's still plenty of cause for concern about Asia.
Basically, the economies there are still slowing, and one of their long-term answers for progress is to be increased exports.
With today's surge in prices, the market has recovered all the ground it lost last October and even gained some. In one day alone during that period, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7.2% of its value, but the correction proved short-lived. Today, the Wall Street Journal published research that shed light on how the market was able to turn around so fast. The journal said that while many pension funds and other big institutions sold stock on the day of the crash, individual investors did just the opposite. Richard Wines is Senior Managing Director at Georgeson & Company.
They saw stocks go down almost over 500 points on the Dow. They said, here's the opportunity I've been waiting for. And they stepped up to the plate and bought. And then, of course, that night when even more individual investors heard the news, next day they called their brokers, buy stocks.
That pushed stock prices back up in the days after the crash, Wine said, and helped set the stage for the market's lurch back into record territory today. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
It was not only on Wall Street that the mood was upbeat. President Clinton sent his annual report on the economy to the Congress today. The report says economic growth is likely to continue through next year and that the economy is well positioned to withstand the effects of the Asian financial and monetary crisis. The White House documents also say the recent strong economy is helping narrow the income gap between racial groups, and it says the president's policies have pushed down the child poverty rate. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Every day seems to bring another piece of good economic news for President Clinton. Today, the president sent the Congress a report cataloging the economy's recent successes and future challenges. He unveiled the report, prepared by his Council of Economic Advisers, during a White House ceremony.
As the economic report, as the president makes clear, our economy is strong, our prosperity is deep, our prospects are bright.
Mr. Clinton pointed out that his economic advisers predict continued growth through at least next year. If that comes to pass, it would make the current period of growth the longest peacetime economic expansion in U.S. history. The president said this expanding economy is producing rising incomes for American families.
Since 1993, the income of a typical family has increased $2,200 beyond inflation. We've seen the fastest growth in real hourly wages in 20 years, after 12 years in which real wages actually fell. The standard of living is rising faster than the cost of living now. And America has grown together, not apart, with the poorest fifth of our families seeing the largest percentage jump in their income.
In addition to evidence that the gap between the rich and poor may be shrinking, the president's economic report also highlights signs that the economic gap between the races is narrowing. The president's advisors point out that since 1993, the rise in the median income of black families has outpaced the income gains of non-Hispanic whites. In fact, the median income for black families grew to a record high in 1996, while the number of black families in poverty fell to a record low. The report says the official poverty rate for children fell 2.2% between 1993 and 96, and it says a new experimental poverty rate, which includes medical and tax benefits to low-income families, shows the child poverty rate falling 4.7%. The administration's success in raising the earned income tax credit is a big reason for the better showing in this new statistic, according to the report. Bob Greenstein of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities doesn't dispute that the experimental measure is a better gauge of child poverty.
But the celebration may be a little premature because there are risks that in 97 and 98, the child poverty counts could go up if the reductions in the safety net add more children to poverty than the growth in the economy takes out of poverty.
Those reductions in the safety net will come as a result of the 1996 welfare reform legislation. In fact, says Greenstein, despite the improvements between 1993 and 96, there were already signs in 1996 that a reduction in the safety net at the state level had stopped the improvement in child poverty rates. And even with the improvements touted in the president's report, 1 in 5 American children continued to live in poverty in 1996. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
Today, President Clinton thanked Canada and Australia for offering help in a future military strike against Iraq if Saddam Hussein continues to resist UN weapons inspections. The U.S. has had difficulty getting backing for military action from its former Gulf War allies. The president said, "I hope we can avoid the use of force," but he added, "We must be prepared to act, and I am very grateful that others are prepared to stand with America." Members of the Clinton administration have spoken a great deal about U.S.-led airstrikes against Iraq, but U.S. officials have refrained from talking publicly about toppling Saddam Hussein. That's because there's some question whether, in fact, he could be overthrown as a result of airstrikes, and because there is uncertainty about a post-Saddam regime in Iraq. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Saddam Hussein is likely to survive even a sustained air campaign led by the U.S. If he is to be toppled, many analysts say, his fellow Iraqis will have to do it. There are several scenarios of how this might occur. They range from faintly hopeful to disastrous. Edmund Garib, co-author of War in the Gulf 1990-1991, describes the scenario Washington would like. A Sunni general, with the support of the Sunni-dominated military, takes over from Saddam Hussein.
The Sunni general, maybe with some of the elements of the present regime there, but without Saddam Hussein, maybe consulting, contacting some of the opposition groups, working together and carrying on with the government. And after a while, perhaps having elections, and this is the best case scenario.
But what kind of general might replace Saddam Hussein? Michael Collins Dunn is editor of The Estimate, a biweekly newsletter on the Islamic world. He says the only people who can get close enough to Saddam Hussein to kill or oust him are people in his inner circle.
Most likely he's going to be replaced by someone else in the existing leadership cadre. And that means it wouldn't look very much different, because you would still have people who have been trained to power under Saddam and who are essentially clones of himself in terms of their attitudes and to some extent in terms of their ruthlessness.
Besides a coup or assassination, there is another way Saddam Hussein might fall. There could be a revolution, a general uprising led by the Iraqi opposition. The problem with this scenario is that the opposition is badly divided. Edmund Garib.
The opposition is generally weak, disorganized, and even though they might be united in opposition to the Saddam Hussein government, they are bitterly opposed to each other.
The Kurds in the north are the strongest opposition group, but the two main Kurdish factions have been fighting each other. The Shiites in the south have their own priorities. There is an umbrella group, the Iraqi National Congress, but it is weak. Michael Dunn.
This particular idea of bringing together the Iraqi opposition and trying to create a viable government in exile has been tried, and we have tried it, and we have certainly invested some money in it without a great deal of success. Many of the groups under the umbrella still identify themselves as Kurdish groups or Shiite groups with their own particular set of agendas.
And these differing agendas, as well as the concerns and ambitions of the countries that border Iraq, could lead to the worst-case scenario if Saddam Hussein falls. Edmund Garib.
When the regime collapses, this would open a Pandora's box of regional disasters. It would destabilize not only Iraq, but the region, as opponents rush to settle scores or carve fiefdoms, and as neighbors of Iraq also come in to strengthen and achieve their own interests and maintain their supporters.
Almost no one wants Saddam Hussein to remain in power. The problem is, most alternatives are not much better. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we're following today. A Republican Senate report accuses President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore of evading the law in their fundraising for the 1996 presidential campaign. The White House says the report is highly partisan. And today, the Senate confirmed Dr. David Satcher as Surgeon General. Satcher, who headed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, will be sworn in on Friday. Coming up, Anna Quinlan on her new novel, Black and Blue, on NPR's All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Anna Quinlan wrote a column for several years for the New York Times, and she brings the same kind of observation and careful reporting to her new novel. Graphically called Black and Blue, the book is about the abusive marriage of Franny Benedetto and her husband, Bobby. She's a nurse, the sort of very able supporting player who becomes, as she says, a nurse, not a doctor, an assistant head nurse, not head nurse. Bobby Benedetto is a New York City cop, a handsome, persuasive, charming, and violent man who drinks too much and hurts his wife. He breaks her bones, gives her beatings that keep her away from work, bruises that keep her away from, as she says, her baby sister's sharp eyes and sharp mind. Anna Quinlan, you make a powerful point in the first few lines of this novel. Could you read from the very beginning?
Oh, the first time my husband hit me, I was 19 years old. One sentence and I'm lost. One sentence and I can hear his voice in my head, that butterscotch syrup voice that made goosebumps rise on my arms when I was young. That turned all of my skin warm and alive with a sibilant S, the drawling vowels, its shocking fricatives. It always sounded like a whisper the way he talked, the intimacy of it, the way the words seemed to go into your guts, your head, your heart. Geez, Bob, one of the guys would say, you should have been a radio announcer. You should have done those voiceover things for commercials. It was like a genie wafting purple and smoky from the lamp. Bobby's voice or perfume when you took the glass stopper out of the bottle.
So right away, you just throw us into the idea that love and violence are very mixed up in this marriage.
Yes, absolutely very mixed up in this marriage. Because I think the most important thing is that in various ways, in various manifestations, at various times, these two people do love each other.
The plot of the novel is an account of Franny's effort to get away. She runs. She leaves everything behind except her 10-year-old boy. She erases herself and all her connections to her life in New York. Although what has happened to her is very dramatic and very frightening, she has made herself in her marriage into a very kind of tamped down person, a quiet, almost invisible person. This is a tough character to carry a novel.
Yeah, but I felt a kind of a kinship to her from the beginning because I didn't want her to feel like what we traditionally think of as a victim. That is someone who is not like us and therefore can be objectified, I guess, in some sense by all of us so that we don't have to take her quite as seriously as we would our best friend. I think that when you get to know her during the course of this book, you do get to feel like she could be one of your friends. She's real confident and capable. She does have a sense of humor, although sometimes she feels like it's been used totally in the service of small bitter observation over the course of her marriage. She's a wonderful mother and a good person, and most of the people who come to know her come to like her and treasure her friendship very much, as does her husband, I might add, although he does not have any idea what to do with it.
Franny Benedetto takes a new name, just gets a completely new identity in a new place. And that happens at the very beginning of the book, and we're at least a third of the way in, it seems to me, before we even begin to see the possibility that she can actually have some other life other than this big conversation that she's having with herself about her decision to run and what her life was like. You described that, and this is almost a turning point moment for her. It's on page 72 where she talks about the cycle of abuse followed by regret, followed by loving behavior, followed by, in her case, a miscarriage. Could you just read us part of that?
There's this moment where she's almost trying to justify herself to herself. And she says, maybe it's hard to understand for a woman who has never had it happen to her, never watched her husband sob in contrition with those choking sobs that sound like he's swallowing glass. He made me feel cared for, Bobby did at times like that. Cared for the way no one had ever cared for me. Babied the way I'd never been babied, even by my own parents. He reached me somehow, reeled me back in, rolled me over and said, I love you so much, sweetheart, and touched me so softly all over that I reached for him, although the doctor said to wait and got pregnant again. And lost that one, too. For the best. For the best. When we were dating, I thought it would stop when we were married. When we were married, I thought a baby would help. After the baby, I thought if we had another child, he'd feel better. And when Robert was two, I couldn't leave because those were the formative years, although maybe I didn't think enough about what we were forming, Bobby and I. And when Robert was starting school, I couldn't leave because school was a big adjustment. And I couldn't leave in May because I'd screw up our family summer vacation. And I couldn't leave in November because it would screw up the holidays. So I stayed and stayed and stayed.
Why did you want to write a book about this?
I really wanted to write about this question of identity, about whether we become the sum total of all the people we've loved and cared for and lived with. And when I thought about how to do that, I thought about the fact that one way to answer that question would be to look at whether we become the sum total of all the people that we've loved and then maybe left because they did bad things to us, because they weren't good in our lives. I thought about that question of identity, and it seemed to me so clearly in the lives of women, at least in part a question about marriage and children. And with all of that going on in my mind, it occurred to me that what I really needed to write to explore some of these issues was a novel about a marriage and a really bad marriage, and the more I thought about it, a really violent marriage.
And to make Franny the sort of the careful cataloger of her own life, to give it the kind of dispassionate tone that you've given it, the kind of reporting tone that it has?
I think that's not a reporting tone. I think that that's the tone of a woman who has had to modulate her inner voice for most of her adult life because she's afraid if she says the wrong thing or talks too loud or laughs too hard. Who knows what could happen to her?
Anna Quinlan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda.
Anna Quinlan's book is called Black and Blue. She spoke to us from our bureau in New York City.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. A new study of crash statistics shows that in collisions between cars and light trucks, or sport utility vehicles, the passengers in the cars are 4 times more likely to die than those in the bigger vehicles. In releasing its data today, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety called on automakers to redesign some of their most popular models for safety's sake. From Detroit, NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Sport utility vehicles are one of the big success stories the car business has seen in recent years. Once just a tiny segment of the new vehicle market catering to camping and off-road enthusiasts, four-wheel drive sport utes now seem to be everywhere, especially in the suburbs, where the toughest challenge they may face is driving over the occasional curb. And with more sport utility vehicles and light trucks on the road, it comes as no surprise that there are more collisions between cars and trucks. Now, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has attempted to quantify what that means for passengers. A new study says that people riding in a car are more likely to die in a collision with a truck than they are in a collision with another car. It's common sense, really, given that a truck can weigh twice as much as a car. But Brian O'Neill of the Insurance Institute says it's more than that.
It's not just due to the weights of these vehicles, because similar weight cars don't produce as much harm to other occupants of other vehicles.
O'Neill says the size and shape of a truck make a difference as well. Because sport utilities ride much higher off the ground than cars, the so-called crumple zones in each vehicle, which are designed to collapse and absorb the impact of a crash, don't line up in a collision. O'Neill says the frame rails of a light truck are sometimes nearly a foot higher than the frame of a car, contributing to the mismatch in an accident.
They are penetrating the cars above the frame rails of the cars, so instead of absorbing energy, they're sort of punching through into the car, if you know what I mean.
As a result, the Insurance Institute is calling upon automobile manufacturers to take this into account as they design the next generation of sport utility vehicles. Detroit's automakers don't dispute the statistics included in today's study. They admit that larger vehicles have an advantage in a crash, but they do say the radical redesign of sport utes is not necessary. Barry Felrice, a former federal safety investigator now working for the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, points out that the study looked only at crash data from 1990 to 1995 and didn't take into account safety improvements to both cars and trucks since then.
What are not in all those vehicles are, one, improved side impact protection that all passenger cars had to have beginning model year 1997. It was phased in for about 4 years before then. And this protection was designed solely to improve protection in multi-vehicle crashes.
Felrice adds more cars now have dual airbags for both driver and passenger, which he says saves lives. Further, he says, new regulations to guard against head injuries are also being phased in. Felrice does say the industry is looking at ways to make car-truck crashes less deadly, including the use of lighter materials for trucks.
We are participating actively with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and other governments around the world in research on that issue to see what, if anything, can be done.
Still, redesigning a vehicle is a process which costs millions of dollars, and some analysts say car makers are reluctant to significantly change the design of vehicles that are so popular with customers as they are. A spokesman for one automaker in Detroit today pointed out that if people immediately want to do something to improve their chances in a crash, they should start wearing their seatbelts. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
In Eugene, Oregon, testimony continued today in the civil lawsuit brought by professional golfer Casey Martin against the Professional Golfers Association. Martin suffers from a degenerative condition that restricts his ability to walk. He wants to use a motorized cart during PGA tournaments, but the organization has refused, saying the cart would give him an unfair advantage. Martin says that refusal violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, and he's taken the PGA to court. Allison Frost from member station KLCC has been covering the trial and has this report.
As a child, Casey Martin was able to run short distances and even played soccer in the position of goalie. Now, at age 25, his right leg has been left weak and atrophied by his disease. Martin can walk unaided with a pronounced limp, but the pain of each step makes it impossible for him to walk the length of a golf course. Attorney for the PGA Tour's William Maledon says the organization is sympathetic to Martin's situation, but believes allowing him to use a cart would give him a competitive advantage.
All competitors in any competition bring to the competition different physical attributes, and you can never, under any circumstances, equalize those physical attributes. I don't care whether the person comes with a disability or comes with an injury or whether the person is simply not as strong as the next competitor. Whatever the difference is, you can't equalize those physical attributes. And if you try to do that, then you don't have a competition anymore.
During the trial, Maledon presented videotape testimony from golf legends Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, who said walking is not just traditional, it's fundamental to the game. Martin's attorney, Bill Wiswall, disagrees.
It all depends on how you perceive the issues. And I think, and always have thought, that the key issue in this case wasn't so much as whether Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer or others thought that this tradition should be retained, but it was should be more focused on what the medical condition of Casey Martin is and whether he's at a competitive disadvantage if not afforded a cart.
Martin has no plans to appeal if the judge rules against him. Friends say he's been overwhelmed by the media attention he's received. Martin says he just wants the matter settled so he can get back to his game.
I can assure you this is not fun for me. If I lose, you know, part of me, I'll just accept what he says. I think the judge will make a good decision. I really don't want to appeal, though. I just like to move on with my life.
PGA officials have said they will appeal the decision if the judge rules in Martin's favor. Closing arguments for both sides will be heard tomorrow morning. For NPR News, I'm Allison Frost in Eugene, Oregon.
Now, as a public service, we'd like to remind all coupled individuals that there are 4 shopping days left until Saturday. For those of you who are unattached, take heart. Commentator Brett Leverage has an idea.
As a single man, I find myself viewing the buildup to this Valentine's Day, much as I imagine American Jews, Muslims, and Buddhists might view the hustle and bustle of the Christmas season. Much ado, but nothing to do with me. It doesn't help that this is one holiday not merely co-opted by commercial interests, but seemingly created by them. Don't get me wrong, I'm no Scrooge when it comes to matters of the heart. Quite the contrary, I'm a sucker for anything romantic. The product of a loving marriage of 43 years, I was raised to believe in happily ever after. In past years, I've gamely opted for alternate ways of observing the holiday. Gifts to my mother, dime store Valentines for my female co-workers, bowls of those little candy hearts for all to share. But it's a shallow charade. If you can't celebrate Valentine's Day with passion, you really can't celebrate it at all. I feel like the out-of-work actor who has to watch someone like De Niro get the roles, the money, the fame, and the Oscar. I can no longer pretend to be all that happy for all you lovebirds. For single folks everywhere who currently lack the affection, devotion, companionship, and support, not to mention the physical pleasures that a romantic relationship offers, Valentine's Day serves as a rude reminder that they are on the outside looking in. Look at it this way. Imagine that we had a national holiday that celebrated the state of having a job. All who were gainfully employed would spend the day musing on their good fortune, how much better their lives were with a steady income, how nice it was to have the security, to know where their next meal was coming from. Perhaps we'd even surprise our employers with a bouquet of flowers, a box of candy, or a night on the town. It doesn't sound so bad, I suppose, but it'd be a little rough on those who were unemployed. Just one more reminder of what they were missing. Such is Valentine's Day for the unattached. So maybe, just maybe, the 14th of February should be devoted instead to us third wheels. I'm reasonably certain that we've not yet been assigned a patron saint, so perhaps we should just borrow yours. Here's what I'm envisioning for an alternative Valentine's Day celebration. Every couple invites over a friend who's unattached, and just for one night, they live out their worst fantasy of what couplehood might be like. She comes to the door with her hair in rollers and cold cream on her face. He's unshaven and wearing a ratty undershirt. The fare is frozen pizza and warm beer served on trays in front of a blaring television. The hosts spend the entire evening pointing out each other's many deficiencies until he finally falls asleep on the couch and she wanders off to bed alone. That'd be enough to make most lovesick, lonely hearts swear they weren't missing a thing, that perhaps the single life wasn't so bad after all. So come on, couples across America, it's the least you can do. For just one night, convince the rest of us that love stinks.
Brett Leverage lives in New York. His essays can be found on his homepage, www.brettnews.com.
The writer who sued Steven Spielberg and his production company DreamWorks for plagiarism has settled her claim. Barbara Chase Raboud had accused the filmmakers of cribbing from a novel for the movie Amistad. Details of the settlement are secret, but in a statement released by DreamWorks, the writer appears to absolve the studio and the director of any intellectual theft. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports from Los Angeles.
Barbara Chase Raboud had originally sued for $10 million, claiming that the movie Amistad had helped itself to key creative elements of her 10-year-old historical novel Echo of Lions. And as Amistad prepared to open last December, Chase Raboud's lawyers took their copyright infringement claims to the legal limit, asking a judge to actually prevent the movie's release. The judge wrote that the copyright infringement claim, quote, raised serious questions about the movie, but refused to stop its release. It was a victory for DreamWorks and Steven Spielberg, yet the much-publicized charges by an African-American writer threatened to taint this movie about the African-American experience, a serious movie with Oscar potential. The terms of the settlement prevent both sides from releasing details. Today, DreamWorks would not comment beyond its written statement, which quotes Barbara Chase Raboud to the effect, "After my lawyers had a chance to review DreamWorks files and other documents and evidence, my lawyers and I concluded that neither Steven Spielberg nor DreamWorks did anything improper." And, quote, "I think Amistad is a splendid piece of work, and I applaud Mr. Spielberg for having the courage to make it." Beyond that, says the author,
"I'm not going to make any other comment on that statement, and I'm not going to make any comment on the statement."
At one point, DreamWorks reportedly offered $500,000 to settle and a mention in the credits. Neither side is disclosing now what, if any, monetary settlement was made. Barbara Chase Raboud did confirm something future audiences could figure out for themselves. Will those who see Amistad on the screen, it's still playing, obviously, or later in the video version, the home version, will they see a credit of any kind?
No, they will not see a credit of any kind, but they can always read the book.
One of the outcomes of the lawsuit, Chase Raboud's Echo of Lions, will soon be back in print. As for Amistad, the $70 million story of a slave rebellion has done medium well at the box office, and today it received 4 Oscar nominations, including costume, score, cinematography, and Best Supporting Actor. Renee Montaigne, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. The motion picture Titanic dominated the Academy Award nominations announced this morning, picking up 14 nominations, including Best Picture, Actress, and Director. The other Best Picture nominees were As Good as It Gets, L.A. Confidential, Good Will Hunting, and The Full Monty. There's one category of filmmakers who are never nominated for Oscars. They work for the cinematographer, and their title in the closing credits is always eye-catching. NPR's Susan Stamberg went to Los Angeles to learn more about Best Boys.
52, take two.
Okay, here we go.
They're not called B-movies anymore. Low budget is okay, though. And this film, Memorial Day, a political action thriller that sounds like Manchurian Candidate meets Oliver Stone, is definitely low budget. Short shooting schedule, small crew. One crew member has parked his truck right near the action of this day's shoot at a Los Angeles cemetery. The one-ton truck is jammed full of electrical equipment. Lights, dimmers, gels, cables.
These are 60-amp phase cables, and you can tell by the end. And then this is a 108 phase cable, weighs about 45 to 50 pounds, and it can carry a 100-amp load.
25 years old, wearing a baseball cap and Paul Newman blue eyes, Star Barry, yes, that's his name, is responsible for all this electrical equipment. He's gathered it together for the shoot, will check it out and in for various scenes, and get it all back up on the truck and inventoried when the filming is done. He works 12 to 15-hour days, earns $125 a day, he is non-union. Star Barry is a best boy.
Best boy to me means the best.
Bruce White is one of the stars of Memorial Day. You may remember White from Hill Street Blues. He was that scruffy Detective Belker, the guy who kept biting suspects.
The best boys are movers, loaders, shakers. They probably work as hard or harder than anybody on the set, certainly harder than the actors. And they're invaluable, and we can't do without them when we shoot a movie.
And they make you look good.
Nothing can make me look good, Susan.
But if the best boy does his job right, getting power to the set, making sure all the equipment works, then telling his electricians what to do, if it's done right, the best boy makes everyone look good. Herbert Hughes started off as a best boy. Then he was head of the lighting department at Disney for 24 years. Hughes worked with all the electrical people, including gaffers. You've seen that title in the credits, too. Gaffers are the chief lighting technicians. Herb Hughes says it was gaffers who helped create the title Best Boy.
Years ago, studios carried staff gaffers. They were on payroll whether it was a picture or not. Cameramen tended to come in on pictures being brought in by the producing company or whatever. And a lot of times a cameraman would be introduced on the stage to his gaffer. And along with that, there would be a crew that normally worked with this man. And I was told that the cameraman's first question to him after he'd made his introduction was, "And who's your best boy?"
In those days, boy was a common term. It stuck, although at the unionized big studios, it's been fancied up to assistant lighting technician. Whatever the title, the best boy is Mr. Electricity. On the Memorial Day shoot, that's Star Barry.
You got to respect electricity. You know, don't be afraid of it, but just realize that if you do the wrong thing or if you're not thinking all the time, then you could get seriously hurt.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Again, Herbert Hughes. Retired now, he teaches at the University of Southern California School of Cinema Television. Herb Hughes knows how dangerous it can be to work with electricity.
The idea that you can go 40 years in the business and not lose your fingers or part of your eyesight is a miracle. When it's done right, nothing happens. And when it's done wrong, it's like a hand grenade going off.
In his long lighting career, Herb did it right. Herbert Hughes is something of a legend. He once asked Walt Disney to put his name on screen. Disney promised he would. Hughes thinks that's why the VW Beetle in The Love Bug is named Herbie. Herbie Hughes got into the movie electrician business by chance. He had come to Hollywood to visit a Navy pal.
Just was offered a one-day job over at 20th Century Fox during a picture called Can-Can way back in 1959. And I fell in love. I found what I wanted to do, and there's never been a bad day in the last 40 years, as far as I'm concerned. It's been fun every day.
They worked wild schedules in the old days when the big studios were pumping out movies, hauling lights that weigh nearly 250 pounds, shouldering 100-pound cables. Herbie Hughes remembers hearing stories of contests before his day when electricians would load three or four massive cables onto their shoulders and then race up to the wooden catwalks where the cable is placed before it's uncoiled to light the stage.
It was always to see who could carry the most, who could carry the fastest up that 40 foot of stairways. It was a heart buster. It was a killer, and I don't know that anybody ever died of it, but it made the day go by.
There are best women, by the way, and best older men, but not that many. The physical demands are too great, and there are other demands.
I did it for a week, and I quit, and that was my first and last best boy job.
At the age of 23, Mike Karasik is a veteran of 14 movies, but only one as best boy.
It wasn't my thing. It requires a certain type of personality that I just don't have, you know. Someone who's very into the equipment, and very organized, and very anal, and I'm not.
Mike Karasik prefers to be a gaffer. That's the chief lighting technician, remember, the best boy's boss. Mike has gaffed on Black Scorpion 2, Circuit Breaker, Seawolf. He was making a list for the anal best boy on his next film.
Two Big Eye 10Ks. Two baby 10Ks, four baby 5Ks, six 2K Fresnels, eight 1K Fresnels.
The equipment has become more sophisticated since the days when Herbert Hughes began working with lighting at Disney. And Herbie says there have been other changes over the years. Best boys, gaffers, all the electrics need to be smarter today to work in the industry.
We're not a bunch of working animals anymore. We're a bunch of truly artisans, because when you start doing a thing like the Titanic, and I know both the men that rigged that, Mr. Amorelli and Mr. Greenberg. Truly, these men are artisans. I mean, it's the same as Michelangelo taking a big piece of rock and turning it into a David. These people take a bunch of cable and turn it into a marvelous machine that works, that does everything that the director wants it to do, everything the cameraman wants it to do. That's a real craft.
Mark?
In 52, take one.
Back at the Memorial Day shoot, Best Boy star Barry is down off his truck and helping to focus an immense light on two actors. This is Star's 30th besting job. He's done films, videos, and commercials for a year and a half now.
And did you grow up, were you a kid in a cradle saying, someday I'm going to be a best boy?
No. I grew up saying, someday I'm going to be a big actor. And so I moved out here, and this was a way to get into the industry, and I've learned a lot, and I like it, you know.
And you want to stay doing this, or do you still want to be a big actor?
Oh, I still want to be a big actor.
Star Barry, best boy today, but tomorrow... I'm Susan Stanford, NPR News, Los Angeles.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The Senate committee that investigated 1996 campaign fundraising is almost finished writing its final report. While the document has not been officially released, NPR has seen a draft of most of it, and the report reflects the deep partisan split that marked the hearings. Among its conclusions is that Vice President Al Gore was aware that a 1996 visit to a Buddhist temple was aimed at raising money for Democrats. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The hearings went on for 30 days last summer and fall. Unlike the congressional probes of Watergate or Iran-Contra, they were plagued by a never-ending partisanship. That tone continues in the final report. It's some 30 chapters long, roughly 1,500 pages. Most of it was written by the Republican majority with no Democratic input. The Democrats wrote their own dissenting chapters. Trevor Potter is a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission.
Even the manner of the report's release indicates what I think has bedeviled the committee all through it, which is they've had a great deal of trouble getting people's attention and getting their views across. And here again, people have read bits and pieces of it. By the time the whole thing is out and their recommendations are laid out on the public record, it may be that people will regard it as old news as well.
Committee Republicans say the Democratic National Committee had to feed the advertising beast of President Clinton's reelection effort, the television campaign devised by consultant Dick Morris. The committee says the White House and the presidency were reduced to tools for fundraising. The report hits hard at Vice President Al Gore, who attended a fundraising event at a Buddhist temple near Los Angeles. According to committee Republicans, Gore's office knew the event was a fundraiser. Gore's office released the letter of invitation from the event's organizer, Maria Shaw, who described it as simply a rally. Republicans say the episode will haunt Gore's presidential bid. Republican National Committee spokesman Clifford May says the Senate panel did its job despite Democratic attempts to brush aside the allegations.
What you have the Democrats doing, and sadly, is sort of dismissing that and saying, oh no, let's not look at that. There's nothing there. There's nothing proven. It's not the job of the Senate investigatory committee to prove these things. They're supposed to reveal some facts, and then the Justice Department and others should be prosecuting. And we hope they'll do their job.
But after a year of investigating, the committee was still unable to answer some big questions or to agree on some others. For example, the committee set out to learn more about John Huang, a Clinton supporter with close ties to the wealthy Riady family of Indonesia. Huang worked for the Commerce Department for 18 months and had access to classified trade information. He later invoked the Fifth Amendment and never testified at the hearings. The committee's final, uncertain conclusion, his stint at Commerce is difficult to understand. Committee Chairman Fred Thompson set out to show money connections between Democrats and the People's Republic of China. The committee report refers to several, but the details remain classified. DNC Chairman Steve Grossman says there's nothing to know.
I think we all know that on the opening day of the hearings, Chairman Thompson alleged some grand conspiracy. 3 million tax dollars later, all he was left with was what he started with, allegations and innuendo.
On the other hand, the Democrats wrote a chapter harshly critical of former Republican chairman Haley Barbour for his role in soliciting a loan guarantee from a Hong Kong millionaire. The guarantee enabled a nonprofit to repay the Republican National Committee just before the crucial 1994 elections. Committee Republicans also wrote about the nonprofit and completely exonerated Barber. Trevor Potter says it's not surprising the investigation ends in conflict, since the committee was never able to agree on its basic mission.
I think the committee hoped that it would be able to come up with a conclusion and maybe even a roadmap of how to fix whatever parts they thought were broken. But as you can see from the fact you're going to have a Republican and a separate Democratic report, there isn't an agreement on the committee over what happened, what was broken. And again, I don't think at this stage there's an agreement on what ought to be fixed, if anything.
In fact, not even the Republican committee members agree on the problem. Thompson and a few others want to pass a campaign finance reform bill. Other committee Republicans say the bill would make the situation worse, not better. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
It has been more than 3 years since the U.S. has had a Surgeon General. Today, the Senate confirmed Dr. David Satcher for that job. When he was selected by President Clinton after Dr. Henry Foster's failed nomination, Satcher was thought to be a safe, non-controversial nominee, but his supporters in the Senate had to beat back conservative criticism over late-term abortions and other issues. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Critics say the Surgeon General is essentially superfluous, with at best an indirect influence on public health matters. But for a symbolic position, it's certainly given the White House more than its share of headaches. The plain-spoken Dr. Joycelyn Elders was forced to step down after a series of controversies, including comments on sex education that conservatives portrayed as an endorsement of masturbation. She was followed by Dr. Henry Foster, a widely respected physician who was defeated by Senate Republicans following a bitter campaign led by conservatives who refused to vote for a doctor who had performed abortions during his career. It was in this hostile atmosphere that the White House turned to Dr. David Satcher, a physician who began his career in Los Angeles fighting sickle cell anemia in Watts and went on to head the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Satcher gained praise from both sides of the aisle, but abortion opponents marshaled their forces for another fight, because Satcher shares President Clinton's opposition to a complete ban on the late-term abortion procedure critics call partial birth abortions. They found their champion in Missouri Senator and presidential hopeful John Ashcroft, who argued that Satcher's views were not in line with those of much of the health community.
Partial birth abortions are not indicated, they are not necessary, and that to endorse the political agenda of the president rather than the health agenda of America is inappropriate. This is about whether someone who is indifferent to infanticide can care for our children.
Ashcroft also criticized Satcher's involvement in infant HIV studies and needle exchange programs. Tennessee Republican Bill Frist, the Senate's only physician, rebutted each argument in turn and said Satcher's goals to raise the profile of children's health issues, promote sexual abstinence among teens, and serve as an inspirational role model are exactly what the country needs in a Surgeon General.
Personal responsibility and prevention, that is Dr. Satcher's agenda for the future. Dr. Satcher has dedicated his career to public health. He's well qualified to lead the United States Public Health Service and its commissioned officers to meet these worthy goals.
The criticisms faded in the face of Satcher's career and achievements. Minority Leader Tom Daschle said among the nation's health organizations, there was no doubt about Satcher's qualifications.
Every single organization in this country, with any standing, with any credibility with regard to health care, has said, this is an extraordinary individual, a leader in health care. The Senate ought to confirm him today.
Daschle said after 3 years of partisan battle and controversy, it was time to acknowledge the need for a Surgeon General to address critical public health issues.
That's what this is about, acknowledging that void. Recognizing the need for leadership, recognizing the agenda in health care, especially recognizing the importance of putting emphasis on children's health and the anti-smoking campaign and the array of things that only the Surgeon General can do.
Satcher was confirmed on a bipartisan vote, 63-35. He's scheduled to be sworn in Friday. The Satcher nomination is a victory for the White House, but trouble is looming on another front. Pennsylvania Judge Frederica Messiah Jackson's nomination to the federal bench was set for a Senate vote today, but has been postponed in the face of last-minute opposition from conservatives and Pennsylvania police and prosecutor groups who call her hostile to law enforcement. Judiciary Chairman Orrin Hatch, a former supporter of Messiah Jackson, now says he thinks the judge was less than candid with his committee, and he considers the nomination in serious question. Supporters are scrambling to get her another hearing. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Many communities around the world add chlorine to the public water supplies to kill dangerous germs such as cholera. But a new study suggests there could be a downside to this common practice. The study suggests that women who drink a lot of tap water containing high levels of chlorine compounds could be at higher risk for miscarriage. The findings are far from definitive, but they're creating a stir in California, where secondhand reports of the study have been circulating. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
For more than 15 years now, Shauna Swan at the California Department of Health Services has been trying to figure out whether the risk of miscarriage is related to water contamination. She's published several provocative but inconclusive studies on the subject, and two more are about to appear in the journal Epidemiology. One study looked for the first time at chemicals related to chlorination called trihalomethanes, and it found that women who drink more than 5 glasses of water with high levels of trihalomethanes were somewhat more likely to have miscarriages. The risk of miscarriage rose from an expected 10% to 16%. News of this conclusion has been circulating in the halls of Los Angeles city government, and today the Los Angeles Times reported that officials there are worried. Shauna Swan, who headed the research, is a bit taken aback by this response.
I think they're overreacting because, first of all, as I said, it is the first study of its kind. And secondly, I think we have to remember that in our study, only 2% of women had high personal exposure to total trihalomethanes.
In order to find any effect at all, Swan had to focus on the 2% of women who drank lots of tap water that had relatively high levels of trihalomethanes. She found nothing amiss among the 98% of women who drank less of this tainted water. And even then, the risk isn't clear. For example, you'd expect that women who drink bottled water, which is free of these contaminants, would have a lower rate of miscarriage. But Swan says that wasn't true in all three counties she studied.
While in the Santa Clara Valley, bottled water drinkers had lower miscarriage rates than tap water drinkers, we did not see that in our other two study areas.
So the link between contaminated tap water and miscarriages is muddled. It's always possible with an exploratory study like this that the result is a fluke, a red herring. But Noel Weiss at the University of Washington in Seattle says it does raise an important question.
I would say that this study is very provocative, and it suggests that there's definitely something to look at. That's definitely something to investigate further to see if there's more than a red herring. But at this point, I don't think we can say for sure one way or the other.
Weiss and Swan agree that the finding isn't strong enough to change the way drinking water is processed, but Swan says women who are worried can call their local water companies to find out the level of chlorine-based chemicals in the water. She says chances are there's nothing to worry about, but if the levels are high, boiling the water for a minute will bring them down. She says pregnant women should not cut down on their water consumption. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
In other news we're following today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average reached a record high. At one point, the Dow was up to 8320. It ended the day at 8295, up 115 points, or 1.4%, from yesterday's close. 641.5 million shares traded hands. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained more than 18 points to close at 1709, its first close above 1700 since October. Still to come on the program, the Winter Olympic Games and how the world is seeing them on NPR's All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. As the fourth evening of the Olympic competition gets underway tonight, we are reminded that the Nagano Winter Games are an international broadcasting event. Each nation adds narration to the video and sound provided by the Japanese to emphasize national heroes and favorite events, and to provide feature stories suited to local tastes.
In Japan, the games are broadcast on television all evening long with highlights many times a day. People in Japan can also sign up for 24-hour satellite coverage. In England, on one channel of the BBC, there's live coverage from midnight to dawn. The other BBC channel has highlights the next day.
And up in Norway, television viewers who want to stay up late can watch hours and hours of the Winter Olympics coverage overnight. NRK Television, Norwegian National Broadcasting, shows events in their entirety, except where schedules conflicts occur. Sylvie Grotmal works for the network in Oslo.
We broadcast live from all the arenas where we have Norwegian participants, and daily coverage is about 10 hours Besides, we have a magazine in prime time in the evening where we sum up with highlights of the events. I say we cover all the sports where Norwegians participate, but then again, we have, for instance, no participants in the sport that probably is biggest with you, figure skating. The home country of famous Sonja Henie never really has produced a good figure skater after her.
Sylvie Grothmoel says his viewers in Norway want as much coverage as possible of their national sport, cross-country skiing.
TV viewers in Italy also can stay up late to watch 8 hours of live coverage. Andrea Bongiovanni, a journalist for the Sports Gazette in Milan, says an Italian sports hero is on everyone's mind.
As we have Alberto Tomba, one of the most important skier, we are waiting for him to be in the competition, but he didn't start skiing yet. So far, we didn't have many athletes in the Olympic Games so far. So probably people are watching for ice skating and maybe some cross-country skiing too, because we have a few good athletes there.
And people in Holland can forego sleep to watch the Olympics unfold live, or, says Dutch television's Ewald van Vinsen, watch the highlights at midday.
We have, to be honest, only one sport, that's the speed skating. We have about 15 competitors there, and it's very popular in Holland. And in the early morning hours, about 7 o'clock till 10 o'clock our time, that's the event people would like to see in Holland.
Viewers in this country, of course, are watching CBS television coverage. Michael Hiestan writes about television and sports for USA Today. He says we are seeing a mere fraction of the actual events because of commercials and human interest features.
It's programmed for people who don't follow sports generally and don't follow these Olympic sports, which on a regular basis, which is just about everybody in the U.S.
So people who are tuning in to watch a complete hockey game or, pray tell, even a little bit of curling are just not going to get to see it this time.
No, they aren't. They join the people who in the summertime are looking forward to equestrian events and archery.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is frustrating. Let's say you tune in to watch cross-country skiing,
mm-hmm.
World-class athletes. They seem, and this is true of other networks as well as CBS,
mm-hmm.
goes way back. They seem to start the event, let it go for 17 seconds, and then right away you're at the kitchen table, you know, back home in whatever country, and usually there's an accident involved in the story, and this seems to be the way that things are covered.
Very much. Snippets. It's meant to be a long-running miniseries, not sports programming. It's almost, demographically, it's almost a flip side of a regular traditional sports audience, which is maybe two-thirds male and people who know all the players and know many of the statistics. This is for people who don't normally watch sports, and you know, you have to be set up. Who is this athlete? What human difficulty have they had to overcome to get to the top of the bobsled run? And then you see snippets of it. You know, they've tried in the past. People have heard the complaints about, let me see more raw sports. And 92 NBC tried putting it on pay-per-view, saying you can see everything about everything. They lost many millions of dollars.
NBC had a triple cast, and you could sign up for a channel and just watch it.
Raw.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because it's all available on the World TV feed, you know, that has every event all the time. And, you know, this has been a formula that has been going now for decades since Rune Arledge thought it up for ABC, a combination of local color, human interest, and a little bit of sports action. Of course, the Winter Olympics is all built around the anchor of figure skating.
Figure skating and the drama of that. But certainly women, anybody who doesn't watch sports on a regular basis, you can get involved in a very arcane sport. Seeing it for the first time can be very, very exciting.
Uh-huh.
Are you sure, is everybody sure that this is the only way to do it and possibly break even on a telecast?
It's just the conventional wisdom. And CBS, by the way, although their ratings are below their guarantee and might have to do some give backs, they were looking at a $40 to $50 million profit on these games. The theory is, if you're actually interested in these sports, you have to watch, because this is a monopoly.
That's right.
The only channel covering it. So what they're going for is the marginal viewer who really doesn't care about sports but maybe can be lured. It's sort of like a political election where you take your partisans for granted and you're trying to lure the swing voters.
The time zone with Japan, we're in a sort of a different situation. Before, we were forced to watch things that were shown virtually. I think they called it virtually live. Right?
Plausibly live.
Plausibly
was the term before it was ridiculed and the term was retired.
Okay. Well, so now, at least if it wouldn't snow, we could get to see the downhill skiing.
Yeah,
right?
In a way, CBS has been kind of brave to break out of the formula. They had the opening ceremonies live. They had, you know, will have some other things live, have had some things live. Whereas when NBC had the Atlanta games, obviously in an American time zone, everything was taped.
Right.
Tape gives you control. You can slice it and dice it, you know, and make it like a TV commercial. Live, you can have delays and glitches. And so in a way, CBS is sort of breaking the pattern.
And I saw somebody writing in a newspaper criticizing CBS for not packaging the opening ceremonies.
Well, you know, this is the thing about the Olympics. Everybody's got a complaint, but all the complaints are different.
Michael Hiestan writes about television and about sports for USA Today.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Today in Israel, leaders of the Reform and Conservative Jewish movements resumed their legal battle with the Orthodox religious establishment. The non-Orthodox groups revived a petition asking Israel's Supreme Court to force the government to recognize their converts as Jews. The move came after Israel's Orthodox chief rabbinate rejected a compromise that would have involved Reform and Conservative rabbis in the conversion process. The dispute has also shaken Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's fragile coalition government. From Jerusalem, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
50 years after its creation, Israel still can't answer one simple question: who is a Jew? Until now, the answer has been anyone born of a Jewish mother or anyone who had an Orthodox conversion to Judaism. With Reform and Conservative Jews challenging that answer, Prime Minister Netanyahu appointed a government commission to try to work out a compromise. After 8 months of discussions, the commission came up with a plan it hoped would make everyone happy. The idea was a joint institute to prepare candidates for conversion with teachers from the three mainstream groups of Judaism. The conversion itself would be done according to Orthodox Jewish law. Reform and Conservative Jews accepted the compromise, even though it meant they would not be able to perform conversions in Israel. But yesterday, the chief rabbinate said no, and today the Reform and Conservative movements went back to court. Reform leader Rabbi Uri Regev says the chief rabbis are attacking the vast majority of Jews throughout the world who are non-Orthodox.
It clearly is a declaration of war against the majority of Jews throughout the world. We know that most Jews throughout the world who identify with any of the Jewish denominations identify with Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist. And the chief rabbinate, in its pronouncement yesterday, has announced no such interpretation of Judaism is legitimate.
Rabbi Meir Lau, one of Israel's two chief rabbis, today said that's exactly why a joint institute for conversion would never work.
Let's say two lecturers come, one after another, and the first says, observe the Sabbath. And the second one comes and says, take the car, take the family to the beach. It's okay, the Sabbath of today is not the Sabbath of the Bible. What will happen? People will be totally confused. And that's how you prepare someone for conversion, which is a religious act?
At a symposium on the conversion issue in Jerusalem today, a small group of Reform and Conservative, or as they're known in Hebrew, Masorti Jews, picketed outside in pouring rain. Yael Meir, a lawyer, was one of them.
I'm as much of a Jew as any Orthodox Jew. I'm a Masorti Jew, and I'm an Israeli citizen. I made Aliyah to be in this country. To be able to be a Jew as I believe a Jew is, and I'm as good a Jew as any other Jew.
The controversy is also a political landmine for Prime Minister Netanyahu. The Knesset is currently considering a bill which would codify the chief rabbi's monopoly over conversions. The ultra-Orthodox parties in his coalition had threatened to bring down his government if the bill doesn't pass. A majority of Knesset members today signed a petition against the bill, ensuring its defeat. But in private today, several ultra-Orthodox Knesset members backed away from their earlier threats, saying a new government might be worse. What they didn't say was that leaving the coalition would also mean the loss of tens of millions of dollars they now receive in government funding. The next move is up to the Supreme Court. If it orders the state to register Israeli conservative and reform converts as Jews, that might force the ultra-Orthodox parties to make good on their threats to leave the government. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Today, the United Nations Security Council called for an immediate end to the fighting in the West African nation of Sierra Leone and for a diplomatic solution to the conflict there. A Nigerian-led intervention force has fought its way to the outskirts of the capital, Freetown. The Nigerians are trying to force Sierra Leone's military junta to return power to the civilian government it overthrew last May. The junta had agreed to step down in April, but recently that deal appeared to be falling apart. Since last year's coup, thousands of Nigerian troops have been in Sierra Leone to enforce a UN economic embargo. The UN also warned today that the fighting could lead to widespread food shortages. From Freetown, the BBC's Mark Doyle reports.
The Nigerians are clashing with forces loyal to the military regime on several fronts in the outskirts of the city. The Nigerian commander, Colonel Maxwell Kubi, said he was intending to take Freetown today. But forces loyal to the military regime are resisting fiercely. As well as regular troops, the military are supported by a tough militia force. In addition to this, unarmed civilians have now begun to mount roadblocks in the center of Freetown. They say they're searching for infiltrators of the Kamajor militia, who, like the Nigerians, want to return to power of the Sierra Leone civilian government. Since dawn, the sound of heavy shelling has boomed around the hills above Freetown and in the eastern suburbs. Thousands of people are moving through the narrow streets of the city, trying to escape the shelling and small arms fire. A spokesman for the Sierra Leone military government said the fighting would continue to the end. Dozens of people have been killed and hundreds wounded in 5 days of fighting.
The BBC's Mark Doyle reporting from Freetown in Sierra Leone.
In South Boston, three families have been ordered to leave public housing there because their children have been accused, though not convicted, of crime. The Boston Public Housing Authority is relying in part on the new federal law aimed at reducing crime in public housing projects. Lawyers for the families say this use of the law is unconstitutional, and they've taken the case to a state appeals court. A hearing on the matter is scheduled for tomorrow. From member station WBUR, Monica Brady has a report.
The Old Colony housing development sits on the water's edge in South Boston. Carol and Larry Berry have a cozy apartment inside one of the drab brick buildings. It's crammed with furniture they used to fit into a three-bedroom apartment until a medical problem forced Barry out of his job as a courier and into public housing for the first time in his life. As his wife fixes tea in their small kitchen, Barry talks about how his 20-year-old son, Keith, was evicted in January for allegedly kicking a Hispanic woman from behind. In separate incidents, two other youths are accused of harassing Hispanics. All three youths say whatever happened wasn't racially motivated. Barry says Keith is now living with family and friends, switching from house to house when the welcome mat wears thin. Larry Berry says it isn't fair the Boston Housing Authority wants to evict him and his wife because of their son's alleged crime.
And I'll tell you what isn't right. It's holding the parents responsible to this degree. As I said, every parent should be responsible for their kid up to a certain point, but not to the point if you take their life or their lives away from them, you know what I mean? We could stand to lose every piece of furniture such as it is, you know what I mean? And my oldest boy can't have a roof over his head. They don't care.
Barry says his son is a good kid. He has no criminal record or prior problems with the housing authority. Larry says the housing authority is taking too hard a line. However, Housing Authority Chief of Staff Hillary Jones says there are good reasons to evict the families.
Number one, you sign a lease that says you're responsible for the conduct of your household members and or your guests. So that's a lease violation right away. And number two, we have found that if you leave family on site, very often the family member or the guest will come back to visit, and they may stay a few days, and the same behavior will start showing its head again.
This is the first time the Boston Housing Authority has used a federal law that was enacted in 1996 to fight crime in public housing projects. Known as the one strike and you're out provision, it allows housing authorities to move quickly to evict a tenant charged with violence, drugs, or civil rights violations. It extends to crimes committed off public housing property and to crimes committed by a tenant's family or guest. The Boston Housing Authority's Chief of Staff Jones says the evictions in South Boston are part of the authority's effort to change the way people think about federally assisted living.
Public housing is not the housing of last resort. In other words, we have right now over 15,000 families waiting to get into public housing. And we are about building strong, positive communities. If the perception of public housing is going to change, then it has to change in a number of ways.
But lawyers in the South Boston case say public housing is the housing of last resort for the families facing eviction, and they say the swiftness of the eviction process is unconstitutional. Brian Burke, who represents two of the families, including the Berrys, says he will take the case all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary.
The law itself and what they are trying to achieve is very admirable, but what it does not take into consideration are two things: the due process rights of these individuals, and also the standards of review that need to be known in advance before you can start holding families accountable for the actions of their children.
Burke says the housing authority didn't make it clear what parents had to do to show they were dealing with a problem child. Parental responsibility in housing law is a question the courts haven't answered yet, says David Bryson with the National Housing Law Project.
It's a close question. Certainly when you're holding one person responsible for the conduct of others in a situation where the person does not know about the conduct of the others or has no way of controlling what the other people are doing, that looks like it's a denial of due process.
Public housing experts say the one strike law has been applied in only a few cases around the country, usually for drug dealing offenses. What makes the case in South Boston different is that the youths are accused of civil rights violations. The evictions have stirred racist embers in South Boston, a predominantly Irish-American community that fought desegregation in the 1970s. It's an area that's been struggling to adapt to the growing number of minorities. The Old Colony housing development is almost 60% white, and Boston police records show the project has the highest number of alleged racial incidents in the city. Boston City Council President James Kelly charges the Housing Authority, whose top two positions are held by minority women, of evicting tenants because of their race.
The message that the BHA is sending out to white people who live in public housing that if there's an incident with a racial minority and if they refuse to turn the other cheek, then they're going to be subjected to eviction.
But the Housing Authority says its figures refute that claim. Over the past 3 years, the number of evictions has been proportionate to the racial makeup of its housing developments. Larry Berry feels confident that when his son gets his day in criminal court, he will be cleared and allowed to return to the project.
All I want him to do is have a fair hearing, and when this thing comes up, when all the facts are out about this thing and everybody gets their say in court, this thing will get thrown out of court.
For now, the Berrys aren't packing up. They and the two other families can stay in the Old Colony housing project while the case continues to wind its way through court. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady in Boston.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. On this date in 1898, Bertolt Brecht was born in Augsburg, Germany. He went on to become one of the acknowledged masters of 20th century theater, whose stage credits include Mother Courage, The Private Life of the Master Race, and The Threepenny Opera, written with Kurt Weill. Brecht also wrote a novel and several collections of poetry. As NPR's Dean Olscher reports, the 100th anniversary of Bertolt Brecht's birth is providing scholars an opportunity to consider his legacy in a new light.
You are about to hear an opera for beggars. Since this opera was conceived with a splendor only a beggar could imagine, and since it had to be so cheap, even a beggar could afford it, it is called the Threepenny Opera.
There's no question the Threepenny Opera is a masterpiece.
There is a question, though, about how much of it should bear the name of Bertolt Brecht.
Here is the Cambridge Companion to Bay.
John Fugie teaches comparative literature at the University of Maryland at College Park.
And when you look under the Threepenny Opera, 1928, I read from that, 31st of August, 1928, premiere of the Threepenny Opera by Hauptmann Brecht by Klammer.
In a book Fugie wrote 4 years ago called Brecht and Company, he argued that Brecht improperly put his name on work written by other people, including his many lovers, and that one of them, Elisabeth Hauptmann, wrote more than 80% of the Threepenny Opera. Siegfried Maves of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill thinks Fugie overstates his case.
These were, after all, not bimbos. These were intelligent women, literate women, and they certainly had their own ideas, and they were capable of making their decisions, but still they contributed to Brecht's work, and we have to ask ourselves why.
The answer, according to James Lyon of Brigham Young University, is that everyone benefited from this arrangement, which was a kind of artistic collective.
He was the franchise figure. His name sold. But more than that, he was the catalyst. He catalyzed these other people to do things for him, to write things for him they never would or could have done on their own. And I've spoken with many of his collaborators. Without exception, there was an unironic sense of privilege of having worked with this man because he was so stimulating to work with. And when they were working together in a collective, they all acknowledged that he was the first among equals and that without him it wouldn't have happened.
Lyon compares Brecht's collaborative methods to Elizabethan theater and Hollywood, too. Where he sees voluntary collaboration by Elisabeth Hauptmann, though, Fugie sees a kind of coercion.
I think that she was coerced by the fact that it was extremely difficult for her as a woman to publish and to be acknowledged in Weimar Germany with the Nazis on the rise, where there was clearly the most basic contempt for women to operate outside either the home or the church.
Hauptmann, who died in 1973, earned up to 15% of the rights from the Threepenny Opera. As a result of Fugie's book, her niece is pursuing the matter with the Brecht estate and his publisher. There's no question that Brecht ran a collective. The dispute is over how to interpret the arrangement. Carl Weber, who worked in Brecht's company during the last 4 years of the author's life, doesn't see anything sinister in how Brecht borrowed from others.
Brecht was enormously interested in input from everyone, not only necessarily the officially appointed people like directing assistants or the designer, but he wanted as well input from other people. He asked stagehands, for instance, quite often what they thought about a particular moment in the scene and so on and so forth. And if he felt it was a good comment, he tried to implement it into the production. The same he did sometimes with children.
Many of Brecht's defenders view his artistic collective as one manifestation of the socialist ideals he embraced. After World War II, Brecht moved to communist East Germany and established a theater troupe in Berlin. The importance of Brecht's devotion to Marxism is another aspect of his life that is being reconsidered in recent years. Erica Monk, the editor of Theater Magazine, hopes now that the Cold War is over, people will stop viewing Brecht merely as a socialist playwright.
He can be rescued from the clutches of everybody on the left and everybody on the right who wants to shape him into their own image and deny the real radicalism of his work.
Which is what?
The possibility of taking a smart outsider's view of things.
Plenty of Brecht's theories have made their way into modern theater, especially his rejection of sentimentality and his use of drama for didactic purposes. But playwright Tony Kushner, who's been compared to Brecht and who readily acknowledges his influence, thinks it's a bad idea to try to separate Brecht's body of work from Marxist thinking.
And I think that the real engagement with what Brecht is writing about in his plays, in his poetry, and in his theoretical writing absolutely mandates an acquaintance with socialist theory. And even though the Cold War has supposedly brought an end to the great debate between capitalism and socialism, in point of fact, many of the questions that socialism raises, many of which are raised most extraordinarily and eloquently in Brecht, are still incredibly valid. And I think on his 100th birthday, it's appropriate to point out that the work, I think, transcends the collapse of a failed experiment in socialism.
It's interesting to look at Brecht's own commitment to socialism. He won the Stalin Peace Prize and deposited the money in a Swiss bank account. He moved to East Berlin but held Austrian citizenship. And as a person, Kushner says Brecht doesn't seem to have been very nice. Yet his plays and poems show great sympathy for humanity.
There's one line from his most famous poem, To Those Born Later, and it's a poem of great despair written at a very, very, very dark point in human history when the Third Reich has really begun to triumph and its demise is still many years in the future. And he writes this magnificent poem that's addressed to the future, saying when they look back on his work, they'll be surprised at how ugly it is. And he asks for the future to forgive him for the ugliness, because the ugliness comes from a hatred of injustice. And in the future, when there's no longer such a need for such hatred, there'll be more beauty. But in this world, beauty, he says, is almost an obscenity.
The final section of Brecht's poem goes like this. You who will emerge from the flood in which we have gone under, remember, when you speak of our failings, the dark time, too, which you have escaped. For we went, changing countries oftener than our shoes, through the wars of the classes, despairing when there was injustice only and no rebellion. And yet we know hatred, even of meanness, contorts the features. Anger, even against injustice, makes the voice hoarse. Oh, we who wanted to prepare the ground for friendliness could not ourselves be friendly. But you, when the time comes at last and man is a helper to man, think of us with forbearance. This is Dean Olscher, NPR News, Washington.